This is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, August 13th, 2019. I'm Kyle Kellums. For many students in public schools in the region, happy first day of school. Ahead on our show, John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat-Gazette, talks with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics about guns and casinos. They'll discuss comments made by Governor Asa Hutchinson this weekend regarding gun legislation in Arkansas and what may happen next with proposals for a casino in Pope County near Russellville. After this afternoon's Ozarks, stay with 91.3 for NPR's Here and Now. Today, the series on the Grand Canyon continues with a history of the Havasupai, a tribe that's one of many Native American communities connected to the canyon. Here and Now begins at 1 this afternoon on KUAF. Tonight is another terrific Tuesday at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks. This evening, Jesse Dean will play from 7 to 9, and the music, as well as admission to the garden, is free. Doors open to the public at 5. There are two more terrific Tuesdays after tonight. A week from tonight, music from harpist Beth Stockdale. And in 2 weeks, the finale, Dog Days of Summer, when socialized, vaccinated pups can stroll the gardens with their human companions. This is Ozarks at Large. A University of Arkansas professor is heading to the Arctic to be part of a scientific team that will research the impact of climate change on that environment. Peter Ungar, a distinguished professor of anthropology, will be one of about 20 researchers who will focus on the Yamal Peninsula in Russian Siberia. The scientists will be looking at how climate change has an impact on plants, animals, and infrastructure in the region. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek spoke with him about how his research will impact our understanding of climate change around the world.
Have there been studies like this before that take this holistic approach to studying climate change?
Well, most studies like this have been done piecemeal. They're done either on, say, the impacts on the animals, or the impacts on the plants, or even specific species of animals, or the peoples. But rarely is it done sort of holistically to look sort of at the synergy and interactions of the different elements with one another.
And what kind of a difference do you think that'll make to have all these researchers and experts looking at climate change together in one place?
Well, look, climate change is going to have and is having an incredibly complex impact on our planet, whether we're talking about global warming or extreme weather, and we're hoping to look at both. If we're going to understand that, we need as many tools as possible and as many different experts in as many different areas as possible. Because you've got all these feedback loops, right? Because the impacts of, say, I don't know, extreme weather on the vegetation is going to feed back into the animals, and that's going to feed back into the people, and that's going to feed back into the infrastructure, and that's going to feed back into the abiotic, the non-life part of the environment.
So why the Yamal Peninsula? Why go there to study climate change?
Oh, it's really cool. It's several hundred kilometers in length, and it actually runs from boreal forest in the south, these big pine trees, up to tundra desert in the north, and it's bounded in the north edge by the Arctic Ocean. And so it's this completely enclosed area that spans four of the five different major ecosystems represented by the Arctic. And it's all in this one, again, enclosed area. And that's going to make for almost a microcosm of what's going on in the Arctic as a whole. And so it'll be possible to understand things in this confined area that hopefully we can extrapolate from to understand the bigger picture.
How can you take that small of an area and apply it to what's happening in other places?
Because we're focusing on the processes, not what's happening to specific animals, but how, say, extreme weather is, say, in the wintertime, it's going to get warmer and you're going to get these rains, right? And those are going to turn into ice. And that ice is going to completely cover the tundra. And so the reindeer aren't going to be able to burrow in to what's normally snow, but is now ice, to eat. And so they're going to starve. And when they starve, the people who herd those reindeer are going to starve. And understanding these interactions between these various different elements and how climate change is impacting it, well, we can extrapolate that throughout the entire Arctic, even if the specific particular examples are in this one area.
In just the last couple of weeks, there have been reports of the huge ice melt in Greenland because of the heat wave there, and the deaths of hundreds of reindeer in Norway that had starved to death. Why is the Arctic so particularly susceptible to climate change?
Well, it's actually an interesting phenomenon because as the Arctic goes, the rest of the world goes. The Arctic is covered in ice, right? And because it's covered in ice, ice has a high reflectance, right? And so when the sun's light hits the ice, it bounces back out. That keeps the Arctic cool most times. When you wear a white shirt, you're cooler than when you wear a black shirt. When the ice melts, well, the underlying ocean is darker, and so heat becomes absorbed. And this phenomenon just feeds back on itself, and the Arctic is heating much more rapidly than the rest of the world. That's a problem for two reasons. First, because as the Arctic goes, the rest of the world will follow. And second, because the Arctic contains, as you just mentioned with the Greenland ice sheets, a lot of free water that's bound up in ice. And when that free water melts, where's it going to go? Basically, we're going to flood coastal areas.
As part of this research team, you'll be leading the group that will be looking at the effects of climate change on the ecology of the people and the mammals of the Yamal Peninsula. What does that entail?
Well, at this point, this is really a planning grant. When you have a team as large as the one that we're envisioning putting together, it takes a lot of work to plan a major research project. And so we're going to meet twice with this group of 20 scientists, with the local stakeholders. We're going to meet with the Nenets peoples. We're going to meet with the owners of the hydrocarbon extraction industry companies. We're going to meet with government officials, and we're going to basically plan out a much larger scale project, hopefully a seven-figure project. And in order to accomplish this and bring as many scientists in and integrate them, we've got to have these planning projects.
And what are you most looking forward to in doing this kind of research?
Well, personally, it's a new focus and a new direction for me in terms of my research. I study teeth and the evolution of human diet, and I study how climate change over deep time made us human. But this is something entirely different. It's something that has not just interest, but actually relevance to today. And trying to get a better understanding of how all these different parts come together, interacting with all these brilliant scientists from all over the world, these things are what gets me excited about the project.
So speaking of today, climate change, highly politicized in this country, a lot of people still deny it's happening. Do you think a project, a research project of this magnitude, would change some minds?
I don't think so. I think people are pretty well set in their beliefs. On the other hand, if you look at the polls, you'll see, and I don't mean the North and South polls, I mean the political polls, I think you'll find that more and more people are actually acknowledging that the world's climates are changing. Whether those are due to anthropogenic or human-induced causes or natural causes, I think most people are now coming to terms with the fact. It's hard to deny. All you've got to do is walk outside and see it happening. So I see that as less of an issue today than perhaps 5 years ago.
Since the goal of this research is to see how climate change impacts all these different facets of the environment, is there a hope that this knowledge will perhaps allow us to be better prepared for what's coming in
That's
the future?
Exactly right. A lot of folks who work in the Arctic, and myself as well, feel it's probably too late to reverse it. We're past the tipping point, at least for the Arctic. And as a result, the best we can hope to do is prepare for the future. And by understanding the feedback loops, the different mechanisms involved, we can better predict what's going to happen in our future, and we can take actions now that will hopefully allow us to deal with and handle it.
So at this point, what does our future look like?
Well, even if we stop producing carbon and emitting it and putting it into the atmosphere, temperatures are going to continue to rise because of the lag that's involved, because of the phenomenon that I've already discussed with the albedo or the reflectance of the pole. We're at least, as far as the Arctic goes, presumably past that point. It's kind of too late. The actions we take today can slow down the process, we believe. But at this point, it's really a matter of preparing for the future and trying to figure out how to accommodate to it as best we can.
You mentioned that this part of the research is the planning phase. So what will your next 2 years on this project look like?
Well, for me, what it's going to look like is I'm going to develop a course that's going to be team taught between the University of Arkansas and the University of Michigan. We're going to have guest speakers in this course from all over the world. I'm going to meet a couple of times in the Yamal itself up in Siberia. And we are going to plan this major grant initiative. We're going to take students with us up there. And we're basically going to put together a strategy for understanding sort of holistically from the perspective of the air, the sea, the land, the plants, the animals, the people, and the infrastructure that's currently there, how best to plan moving forward and how best to study all these different elements and how they interact with one another.
So have you been to the Arctic before?
I've been to the Arctic, but not this region.
So how do you prepare for a trip like that?
Take warm clothes. We're going in the spring and the fall.
Okay.
And we're doing that on purpose. We've got about 12 hours of daylight, 12 hours of night. And what's going to be really fun is it's reindeer days in Salekhard, which is the capital town of this, the most northern point that you can get to with commercial flights in Siberia. And so it's going to be a lot of fun. We'll go, and that'll also mean that we're going to be able to interact with more of the nenets, the local folks, because it's kind of their Olympics of the north.
Yeah, I read the Yamal region has the largest domesticated reindeer population.
Oh yeah, it's insane. And these people are living a traditional lifestyle that they've lived for literally hundreds and hundreds of years.
And they're seeing pretty dramatic changes, I imagine.
Well, there's a combination of factors involved. It's the global warming is changing the tundra, making some of it impassable. And so that affects the migration patterns of the reindeer. The infrastructure that's there, these hydrocarbon extraction platforms also impact and curtail the migration routes of these animals. And of course, the extreme weather and what we call the ice on snow events are basically starving these poor animals who can't burrow in under the snow to get at the moss in the wintertime during their winter grazing season.
And what are the hydrocarbon extraction platforms that you mentioned? What business is that with the...
It's mostly natural gas.
Okay, okay.
This region produces more natural gas than any other part of Russia, and it's one of the largest and most profitable natural gas industries in the entire world. And, you know, we're not trying to stop that. That's not the goal here. The goal here is to work with them. To form a partnership that will hopefully benefit the Nenets people and benefit them. Because if we can learn what the impacts are going to be of climate change, we can help them better prepare their own infrastructure for those changes.
Thank you so much for stopping by and telling us about this research that you'll be doing.
Thank you.
That was Peter Ungar, a distinguished professor of anthropology at the University of Arkansas, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek. The research project is funded by a nearly $240,000 grant from the National Science Foundation. Still to come on today's show, help for a growing segment of our population, caregivers for people with Alzheimer's and related conditions.
And that's, you know, kind of really the root of our mission. You know, we really want to be there to care for the caregivers, because a lot of times they're called the forgotten patient.
Tips and help available at an upcoming caregiver workshop in Bella Vista ahead on today's Ozarks at Large.
91.3 is supported by the Walmart Museum, a family-friendly experience featuring interactive displays on the history of Walmart, Walton's Five and Dime, and the Spark Cafe Soda Fountain. Located on the square in downtown Bentonville, open daily until 9 p.m. Admission is free. 273-1329 or walmartmuseum.com.
The conversation surrounding guns, violence, background checks, and red flag laws continue this week. After mass shootings earlier this month, Governor Asa Hutchinson called for future hate crime legislation in Arkansas, and he discussed that with us on this show last week. On Sunday, he sat down for more than 20 minutes with our partner, Roby Brock, to talk further. The governor says there is a national conversation going on, but he told Roby he's reluctant to embark on a series of gun control legislation. He says controlling guns is not the right solution.
Well, you know, whenever you look at mass killings, we've seen airplanes used for that purpose. You've seen machete attacks used for that purpose, and you've seen firearms used for that purpose. And the United States is a huge population. And so obviously there's a lot of focus, and we do have more than what we would like. But it is something that you see, whether it's in Sweden or whether it's in Australia. You've seen these type of attacks as well, some of them for the same type of radicalized purposes. But there's a national conversation going on, and it's going to continue to look at all aspects of that. But I know that it first starts with, first of all, the individual and their heart, and that somebody is very evil that does this. So we got to address, what, to the extent that we can, how do you have better hearts in America? And then secondly, you know, it's about enforcement, and that's what we go to first. Let's enforce the law. Let's gather the intelligence on it. I think you've got to look at the mental health. I don't see, well, I think it's, you know, a fair discussion on making sure that our laws are effective in keeping felons from having it, or those with adjudicated mental illness from having firearms they shouldn't have access to. Let's tighten up those legitimate areas of concern. That's a fair discussion.
You can find that entire conversation at talkbusiness.net. For their conversation this week, Roby and John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, discussed the governor's comments. John Brummett says he's considered the governor's approaches to guns at length.
I've called myself sort of the Asa whisperer. I think I can see inside him, and I think there's a moderate in there, and it comes out from time to time. And when he's being right wing, he's only doing so because he has to. Possibly, because if he wants to run again, or if, in case John Bozeman should decide to retire, and Asa would go for the Senate running in rural Arkansas for the U.S. Senate, he is not going to give an inch. On guns, because he's got to appeal to the rural gun culture. The other possibility is that I'm wrong, that he's just the same right-winger we always thought he was, who occasionally sometimes has a little hiccup and does a moderate thing. But your interview, and it was fascinating, because he speaks with some compassion and command, having been a former U.S. attorney and the deputy director of Homeland Security, about the white supremacist, and he says the right things about that, and the hate crime law is something that we need. Well, you get him on something not really that horribly controversial, such as a red flag law. And I wrote Sunday, I mean, he gives some legal arguments against a red flag law, but then I ask him, well, will you take the lead in trying to resolve that and make it an administration bill? I thought he was going to come out of a chair. What? Me? Make that an administration bill? No. I mean, he's passive on that. And then you ask him about every gun restrictive legislation in sight, and he's against all of them. And on the issue of background checks, you use the phrase universal mandatory background checks. Well, he'll, okay, universal mandatory. I could watch his mind working. I got that. Well, if you, man, you talk about that, then if a neighbor wants to sell a gun to a neighbor, they've got to go through all this background check. We can't have universal mandatory background checks. As I understand the Toomey Manchin bill, which is the one thing that has a chance in the U.S. Senate, they've now amended personal relationships, friendships, and kinfolk up to cousin level from that requirement. In other words, you got to do paperwork if you sell a car to them, but you can sell them a semi-automatic weapon and they can't be bothered. He relied on that sort of kill that straw man. My judgment on the Twitter, which I'll repeat here, is that he's just scared. He's just scared of the rural gun culture, less than the NRA, maybe scared of them, but they're kind of in an administrative mess. I think he's just afraid to cross them by indicating anything that suggests a concession. There's that. The other possibility is that he's just right-wing on guns. So,
yeah, and I mean, he has had an affiliation with the NRA for a long, long time.
He was their hired man after Sandy Hook, so don't forget that.
Right, and I do think, too, I mean, because I threw the question of open carry out there to him as well, and he believed that that would be a deterrent for people. If there are more people with guns in public places, that would definitely...
Didn't he answer that in the context... See, he's always... He answered that in the context of, well, there was a security guard who was at the... not a Walmart security guard in El Paso, but a person who was a security guard who wished he would have had his gun there. And then he made some quick aside about training. You know, his report after Sandy Hook for the NRA was less arm the teachers and less arm school personnel, but only with training. His reaction to the NRA bill for guns everywhere in Arkansas was, yeah, but with more hours of training. So he relies on that, but he doesn't want to even hint that if you want to carry your gun openly in Arkansas, Ace Hutchinson has a problem with it. He doesn't want it. He will say, well, we need training, you know. If you want an enhanced carry, maybe you need to sit through 30 more minutes of class or whatever. Yeah. But he's not going to cross that culture. And, you know, in the current Arkansas political culture, dominated by rural conservative vote, well, not dominated, but heavily influenced by that, particularly for a Republican, it's either his true convictions or political necessity or both.
Casinos.
Casino.
We're going to be hearing a whole lot about them this week. So in Pope County, as you and I sit down, we are approaching a deadline for casino proposals to be given to the Pope County Quorum Court. They will meet on Tuesday night to pick one. Two of the five casino operators say it's already a done deal that the Cherokee Nation is going to get it in combination with Jerry Jones Legends entertainment venue. And then Thursday, the Racing Commission meets. My prediction, you argue with me on this one if you believe differently. Litigation is what I see in the crystal ball coming here. This is going to get legally very complicated.
I think so. I mean, by that, I assume you mean just one lawsuit maybe you could handle, but there may be crossfires here and back and forth.
You've got one casino proposal that's already appealing their rejection by the commission, which is going to happen on Thursday, and now you got these other two that say the fix is in.
Big picture stuff here, incredible change of mood up there. Pope County had this, Pope County voted against the casino amendment that authorized it. They had a local group that got passed this legally dubious referendum that's not in the state amendment that the public has to vote on this. That was all the rage 6-8 months ago. Mm-hmm. Now they're telling me that the Quorum Court and county judge are going to do this. They're telling me they're going to do this thing Tuesday night, probably ignore this public vote. That's not even an issue anymore. Then you've got every well-connected leading political lobbying consulting group involved in one side or the other. Then you've got, I literally, in reading the Democrat Gazette piece Sunday, which I thought was a good piece, I couldn't have imagined another way to write it. I was drawing a diagram to try to figure out who is who. Who's got the Hard Rock? Who's with Jerry Jones and Steinbrenner's outfit? But the final thing is, you and I spend a lot of time going up and down that road from Little Rock to Northwest Arkansas. That's where most of the commerce and political activity, that's you got business up there, and I go make talks up there a lot. Russellville is a stopping off place already. A couple of good burger places there. this could be a thing. Arkansas River Valley thing, it really could, and the stakes thus.
It's in a sweet spot. Is what you're saying.
It's a sweet spot, and maybe that was going to be the case all along with all the talk about it. If you got a chance to create an entertainment venue and a tourist attraction right there in a place where there's heavy cross country, cross state Little Rock to Northwest Arkansas traffic, I'm stopping there every time I go for a burger. Well. I'm not going to stop for a casino. I mean, I'm not. But there might be something spring up around it.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns can also be found at ArkansasOnline.com. He talked with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics. Their conversations are heard almost every Tuesday on Ozarks at Large. This is a Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large. As the population ages, the number of people in the country diagnosed with Alzheimer's or a dementia-related condition increases. The Mayo Clinic estimates at least 3 million new diagnoses are expected annually. That means more people are caregivers for those diagnosed with Alzheimer's as well. Matt Elmore, the executive director of Alzheimer's Arkansas, says a large majority of those caregivers are family members or loved ones, and he says the caregivers can often be a forgotten patient. Friday, a free workshop for caregivers, professional or otherwise, will be at Concordia of Bella Vista at 1 Concordia Drive. It will take place from 8:30 to 3. Elmore says the workshop, led by area professionals, is designed to help caregivers who can feel completely overwhelmed.
And that's, you know, kind of really the root of our mission. We really want to be there to care for the caregivers, because a lot of times they're called the forgotten patient because, you know, their loved one with Alzheimer's or dementia, they're getting the doctor's appointments, they're getting the medications, they're getting a lot of the attention. And some people kind of lose focus on the caregiver and their well-being. So we really talk about ways to identify those stressors and those opportunities to take a break so you can give yourself some relief. Whether it's something simple as, you know, what's new in technology as far as prescription reminders, all the way to how can you better communicate with your loved one whose communication styles have completely changed to help avoid a few fights throughout the day and some of those struggles. And in 2017, they did a study, and for caregivers who are over the age of 65, almost 40% of them will pass away before the person who actually has dementia. And that's due to, in part, of the high level of stress and anxiety, and a lot of the caregivers kind of neglect their own health and well-being to care for their loved one. So we want to, you know, really push the importance of caring for themselves, and a lot of times the only way that's going to happen is if they can find some different tips and tricks and tools and education pieces to make that day-to-day caregiving a little bit easier.
What is an example of a tip that could help? And I know all caregiver situations are obviously not the same, but what is a tip that can help a potential caregiver just get a bit more time or just get a bit less stress?
Yeah. So probably one of the things that we talk about the most is communicating with someone with dementia. You know, one of the first things to go, and a lot of times the first signs of dementia is, you know, your loved one is going to lose that ability to reason and to really think logically. So we try to tell caregivers through some kind of different scenarios and presentations, you know, try to think about your body language. Try to think about the tone of your voice. Don't try to argue with a loved one who has Alzheimer's or dementia. You know, it's very common people talk about people with dementia referencing loved ones who've passed away, or maybe they want to go home to a childhood home. So we're going to tell them, you know, instead of coming back at that person with, you know, oh, you know, your mom's passed away or you don't live there anymore, try to engage them in more of a conversation like, oh, tell me about your mother. What do you love about her? Why is your relationship so special? Or tell me about your home, where you live. Why do you want to go there? And instead of kind of coming at that immediately with shutting it down and kind of changing their world for them in that moment, to engage better in communication and sometimes to redirect and avoid those hurtful situations that can really negatively change the atmosphere of the whole day with that person.
I know you mentioned that a significant number of caregivers are loved ones. Is there material at this workshop, this session, for people who are professional caregivers?
Yeah, so we do have components for professional caregivers as well. A lot of professional caregivers need continuing education units, so we do have 4 of those available at this event for an array of professionals, anywhere from pharmaceutical professionals to social workers. We'll have 4 of those available for only $10. And but for any personal caregiver or for any professional who doesn't need those education units, it's absolutely free. And we even provide breakfast and lunch for everyone. And we even want to make sure that this event is accessible for everyone. And we know how hard it can be to step away as a personal caregiver. So we offer what we call mini grants. And it's a very simple form that the caregiver will fill out at the event. And within 10 business days, we'll send them a check to help cover the cost if they had to hire someone to care for their loved one so that they could come to this educational event.
Do you ever hear from caregivers who express some form of guilt that they can't do more for their loved one or their patient?
Oh, gosh, yes, all the time. And that's another component of this event that's really great. We try to build it as more of a community collaborative event. So, yes, there will be lots of the moments where you're sitting there listening to us or speakers or getting that education, but there are opportunities to talk with some of the fellow caregivers that are there. And at the end of the day, we end it with a panel. So we'll have some senior care professionals from many different fields that are just literally there to answer your questions for whatever you have. And I think through that, it's good for a lot of those caregivers to see that they're not alone. You know, hey, there are multiple other people here with me going through the same exact thing, and they're asking the same questions that I'm thinking. And it can feel very, you know, solitary when you're going through it. But hopefully through events like this, people can see that you're not alone and that you do have resources and friends and family available through us and many other local professionals.
Matt Elmore is Executive Director of Alzheimer's Arkansas. The organization will host an Alzheimer's Caregiver Workshop Friday from 8:30 to 3 at Concordia of Bella Vista at 1 Concordia Drive. The session is free, and you can learn more at alzark.org/hope. Register there, too. The walk-ins Friday are welcome, and registration Friday morning opens at 8. Elmore also stresses that funds are available for people who attend who need to reimburse caregivers employed so somebody can attend Friday's meeting. And that includes professional caregivers that you might have to pay, a day at adult daycare, or payment to a loved one or family member for the day. A similar workshop, by the way, is scheduled for September 20th in Harrison.
For the Central Arkansas Library System and KUAR, I'm Mark Chris with an Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute. Mississippi County Community College, now Arkansas Northeastern College, was in the vanguard of solar energy use. In 1976, the U.S. Department of Energy chose the fledgling campus to receive the Total Energy Solar Photovoltaic Conversion System, which would generate electricity and hot water. Through the $8.8 million project, 270 solar collectors, each measuring 20 by 7 feet, were installed. And the main building was designed with vaulted glass ceilings and windbreaking devices for energy efficiency. The system was controlled by one of the first Hewlett-Packard desktop computers. Though the Energy Department pledged 5 years of funding in 1982, the Reagan administration slashed the budget and the project was shut down in 1983. 80% of the solar panels were sold for scrap in the late 90s, and the sole remaining panel stands by a plaque commemorating the Mississippi County Community College solar experiment. To learn more, visit encyclopediaofarkansas.net.
The dates for the next Unexpected are now known. Organizers this morning said October 7th through the 12th for the next festival in downtown Fort Smith. It'll be the fifth year for the Unexpected. Artists included in the public art, music, and other events will be announced next month. Allegiant Airlines is announcing a new direct flight from Northwest Arkansas Regional Airport to Phoenix. The low-fare airline says it will begin the flight in November and will offer one-way $69 fares to begin the service. The seasonal route will fly twice weekly. The Phoenix Mesa Airport will be the sixth destination for the airline from XNA.
Walton Arts Center extends their thanks and appreciation to their volunteers who commit their time, talents, and resources to maintaining the arts in the community. New volunteers are invited to join the team. New volunteer orientations will be held on three upcoming dates, August 21st, 27th, and September 7th. WaltonArtsCenter.org/volunteer for more information. Now open at the Scott Family Amazium, Studio Grow. Designed for families of early learners, six and younger, Studio Grow features activities for curious kids. Families can explore on their own or drop in for a weekly Partners in Playdate. Monthly themes explore science, technology, engineering, arts, and math through playful, hands-on discovery. Amazium.org for information.
You've probably heard somebody say music is universal. The musicians in Blue Thread can back that up with research and musical examples. They find songs that have survived centuries and songs from across the world that are connected through social migration. Blue Thread is Christy Catt, a soprano and assistant professor of professional music at Berkeley, and Nicola Radon, a musician, producer, and a music instructor at the University of Arkansas, and often they have guests play with them. Tomorrow night, they'll perform at the Walmart Museum as part of the Live at the Five and Dime series, a Wednesday night series of free outdoor concerts that are a collaboration between the UA Music Department, Walmart Museum, and Downtown Bentonville Incorporated. Last night, Christy and Nicolai came to our Furman Garner Performance Studio to discuss the connections between music as different as medieval songs and Ozark ballads, and they offered a preview of the music they'll perform tomorrow night, like this.
So in Bentonville, we're going to do some of these Cantigas de Amigo, these Galician Portuguese songs. You look in manuscripts, you will find all these poems, hundreds of poems, and then you'll see lines where somebody was supposed to write down the tune, but they didn't write it down because everybody knew it. And so for until the early 20th century, those were thought to all be lost until someone in Madrid, I think it was 1914, opened a book, and stuffed in the binding are these songs, just a handful of these songs, and they're beautiful. And I, many years ago, I started working on learning the notation and figuring out how to do them, but they're really just a reflection. They're little snapshots of the oral tradition.
Christy Catt vocals and Nicola Radon flute. They are the core of Blue Thread. The band will perform tomorrow night from 6 to 8 at the Walmart Museum in Bentonville as part of the Live at the Five and Dime series. During our conversation last night, they explained how Blue Thread came together.
Well, it started actually as a conversation. I know where I was. I was sitting out in my backyard, and I had just asked Nicola to drop everything and go to Portugal. And I had been asked to go and do a concert, and I'm based in Boston, and the people that I was going to go with who are in the Boston area couldn't make it, and so I thought, who can I ask that will go at moment's notice? And so Nicola was one of them, and we decided, we'd been working together for many, many years in different groups, and we decided, if we're going to do this big tour and go to Portugal, let's make it a group and launch something new, and we started discussing.
We didn't actually know that how and where we would go with that.
Right.
I mean, from the point before we went to Portugal, we knew actually the program that we're going to make with. I mean, this is the collection of songs from medieval time from Portugal, coming from 13th century cantigas, the Amigo, and that actually that was a long time research of Christie's. So we got that right. We got in a very nice mood and into that, but then something really miracle, like a miracle happened in Portugal. Besides those performances were absolutely fantastic in wonderful places. But then in one of the performances we met the choir from Cape Verde,
mm-hmm.
who actually, we found that actually that they knew some of the songs, but the Cape Verdean actually, their native song, so it basically has the same story behind it, and then kind of the thread was basically coming out from one place to another. Then we found actually that there must be some connection with India, with Goa, or Sri Lanka. Later on, we found that there's Vietnam, Marshall Islands as well, and then Ozarks.
I ended up, I was actually working on the song, telling the story, you know, working on the story for quite a while before it hit me that I already knew the song. I already knew the story. And I'd sung it for years, the English version. Different melody, but the exact same story. And I knew that Nicola was teaching down here, and I knew versions that weren't from the Ozarks, but they were from, you know, American folk song versions. And so I said, Nicola, we got to look and see if this same ballad is in the Ozark collection. So
true, yes. Then actually last year I said, let's come over here and then get into these piles and of books and some of the recordings, early recordings, field recordings. And we are so lucky that we have actually such a knowledgeable people here at the University of Arkansas, the librarian of the rare books and special collection Joshua Youngblood, who actually said, like, wait a minute, I think I have something that I didn't know that we have. And then actually he found that some songs of the early or field recordings of Emma Dunsenberry back in the 1930s from field recording somewhere in the Ozarks.
From Mena,
exactly. And it was just another world. I mean, you don't hear typical kind of blue grass or anything. I mean, it's basically melodies that sounds like medieval.
Who will be playing with you in Bentonville?
We have two local musicians. One is, her name is Carol Widder. She is going to play cello and accordion. I found the accordion is a beautiful sound background of the you know, and the which basically kind of adds another kind of sound to or tone color to beautiful Christie's voice. Then we'll have also Iranian musician Makhshid Irene Parast, she's a Suntour player, so she's going to give that kind of color, tone color that comes from non-Western, some magical sounds of the medieval time. And so, and yes, and Christy and I, that will be four.
Well, can we have a bit of a preview?
Sure.
Christy Catt and Nicolas Redon, Blue Thread, in the Furman Garner Performance Studio last night. Tomorrow night, they perform with guests at the Walmart Museum in downtown Bentonville from 6 to 8 as part of the Live at the Five and Dime series. That is a collaboration between the University of Arkansas Music Department, the Walmart Museum, and Downtown Bentonville Incorporated. There is much more from the conversation, and we'll hear highlights Sunday morning at 9 on Weekend Ozarks at Large.
This month's Short Talks from the Hill, a podcast of the University of Arkansas, features Austin Williams, co-founder and chief software architect at AmBots. It's a startup technology company located at the Arkansas Research and Technology Park. Williams and his business partners are building a swarm of autonomous robots that work cooperatively to perform complex manufacturing tasks. They dream of a world in which scaled-up versions of these robots can work together to build something as large as a commercial jet.
What we've done is we've made 3D printing scalable, so you don't have to buy individual machines to print different sizes, and you don't have to shell out a ton of cash if you need a big printing system. We actually found a way that we can we can hijack the controls of a forklift and control it with our software.
To listen, you can find Short Talks from the Hill under the On Air and Programs link at KUAF.com, or you can visit researchfrontiers.uark.edu.
George Washington Carver National Monument will host the 4th Annual Storytelling Days event Friday, August 23rd from 6 to 8 p.m., then Saturday, the next day, August 24th from 11 to 3. The event celebrates the establishment of the National Park Service and focuses on stories about American culture and history. It will take place indoors, good to know, in late August, in the multipurpose room. It's free of charge. For more, nps.gov/GWCA. Contributors to the show this Tuesday included Susanna Sitek. Timothy Dennis mastered our show from inside the Harold and Blanche Cox News Studio. Our conversation between John Brummett from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette and Roby Brock with our partner Talk Business and Politics was recorded at the KATV studios in Little Rock, and that conversation comes to us through our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can learn more about Ozarks at Large at ozarksatlarge.com. There you can find past editions of our show, plus past individual stories and interviews, and we have links so you can share them with other people you think should hear them. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Elkins. And KUAF 91.3 is also a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. All right, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda finds music for us to end many of our shows, and we will finish today with the song 22 as performed by J.D. Clayton, a version first heard on Ozarks at Large. J.D. will play at the grand opening of the Majestic in Fort Smith on Saturday night. You can find out more about that at majesticfortsmith.com.
I've been working hard for a while, harder than I thought I'd ever do, but I still know nothing and haven't got a clue. Even at the old age of 22, I think I'm in love. There's a chance she might love me too, but I never would have guessed that I'd end up with you. Just never can tell, 22. And ain't it crazy how we all think that we know something? Listen, babe, I'm just learning how to do the walking, but it's about the right thing you do, and more about the people you choose, and less about the win or lose. You don't have to figure it out at 22. There's a lot of folks who've done me wrong, but I can guarantee I've done things they could sue. Well, it was easy to love and so hard to forgive you. Life's so hard, 22. And ain't it crazy how we all think that we know something? And listen, babe, I'm just learning how to do the walking, but it's about the right thing you do, and more about the people you choose, and less about the win or the lose. Oh, you don't have to figure it out, 22.